Welcome to the Boneyard with Steve Robertson. As always, I am your good friend and host, Steve Robertson. Here on the midweek edition of The Yard, I'll be right back with you tomorrow to give you show number three for the week. And we'll get that done sooner rather than later because we're heading to the beach. First time in a long time that we've had a family vacation. Dana and I have taken some trips. And I guess the last time that we took a family vacation, which ended up being a complete mess, was 2022. We were all supposed to cruise to the Bahamas, and then something didn't get taken care of, and half of us had to stay in Key West, and the other half went to Bahamas. Yeah, so as Ani likes to say, nobody can count that as a full family vacation. And as I've shared with you guys before, Dana's mom, Pat, was very close to me. And if she hadn't been my mother-in-law, I would have picked her to be my friend. I really, really, really hit the jackpot in many respects when it came to mothers-in-law. Now, she had some flaws like all of us do and kind of lost her way a little bit. But Pat was a very strong woman and very opinionated and would absolutely tell you exactly what she thought, good, bad, or indifferent. And I respected that about her immensely. And one of her dreams was to be a writer, and when she got really sick and had to get on chemo and stuff, she messaged me one day, and I put some of this in When the Bottom Falls, but she said, you know, I got chemo brain these days, so I don't know if I'm going to be able to write the way that I want to, and so you're going to have to do it for both of us. And so Flim Flam was dedicated to her memory. And but anyway, so every year, we took a beach trip. Like, so either we went to Disney or we took a beach trip. Just about every year, and one or the other. A lot of times we'd do beach a couple years in a row and then maybe go to Disney every 3 years or so. But Pat was very, very, very instrumental in all that stuff of getting the family together. And it's so interesting, too, that, like, she really wasn't, and I don't mean this in the wrong way, but when I met her, you know, family wasn't her top priority, right? Like, her oldest daughter, Sandy, had left. Dana had left. Mandy was at home, which was kind of like a little companion, more so than a daughter. But anyway, family was just, you know, she was very career-minded, and her writing was important to her, and she really wasn't involved in a lot of family stuff. And again, I say that with as much love as I can muster. But she really found her groove as a grandmother, and if she were alive today, she would tell you as much. When Ani was born, something changed in her. And if you've read When the Bottom Falls, at the very end of it, I've got a letter that Pat had written to me and Dana the day that Ani was born. And I forgot we had it until I was writing that book, and I had to look for some pictures for the book and for the publisher, and stumbled across that letter, and I was able to share it with my children for the first time. And they loved their Granny Pat. I think I've shared with you guys before, Dana's grandmother was Granny Hill. And so the last thing that Pat wanted to be called was Granny, right? And so the first thing that I did as soon as Ani began to form words is to point to her and say, that's Granny. That's Granny. And she was totally against it. And then Ani started calling her Guh. That's all he could get out was Guh. Guh for Granny. And it just melted her heart that child called her Guh. And so eventually she became Granny Pat, and she loved it. And so she organized these trips for us, and it was very important to her that all of us get together. And then after she passed away, none of us really felt like going for a while. I think our hearts needed to heal, and it's kind of unfortunate too because we just kind of stopped getting together as much. And so now Dana's dad said about 2 years ago, he goes, well, why don't we do the beach trips? And you know, Jerry, of course, remarried, you know, 30 years ago. And I'm going to tell you something that most people don't know that's kind of funny. So when Dane and I started dating, it wasn't too long after that we started living together. Yes, we lived in sin. We did. Anyway, so I went to go visit Dana's parents, and of course her dad knew that we were living together, but he said, hey, you know, it's my house, and I'm just going to ask that you respect my house and not sleep in the same bed with her until you guys are married. So I respected his rules. I did. And I slept on the couch both nights we were there, And I can't say I was happy about it, but I did it, right? I did it with a cheerful heart. Well, as fate would have it, Jerry Hill began to date again, and he and Donna, who is now his wife, came to visit us in Hattiesburg. And they weren't married. And so they were going to spend the night, and I said, "Hey, Jerry, listen, you know, I don't know how you feel about this kind of thing, but, you know, my house, you know, we kind of have rules that, you know, if you're not married, you know, you shouldn't sleep in the same bed. So, you know, Jerry, I'm going to have to ask you to sleep on the couch and let Donna sleep in the guest room." Well, she thought that was absolutely hysterical. And he, a man of belief and conviction, had to abide by the wishes of his host. He said, "Piss on you, Steve, piss on you." But you know what? He went and slept on the couch. And so I got a little bit of revenge there. Kind of funny story, but I've got a great relationship with Jerry, and really great guy. And Dana loves him to death. His brother, Eddie Joe Hill, played offensive line at Ole Miss. And so they're all Ole Miss fans kind of for that reason. Like, they didn't grow up Ole Miss fans, but they became Ole Miss fans because their brother played there. Dana so much is not the Ole Miss girl. But nevertheless, a little bit about my family, and you know, I've got some other things a little more personal to share later in the show, but yeah, we're looking forward to getting together. So we talk about this kind of stuff all the time on the show. You know, make memories with the people that you love the most, because you never know when you're going to miss that opportunity. And it kind of hit me yesterday, too. You know, we have three grands, and eventually we'll have some more if God chooses to bless us with those. But I said, you know, this may be the only family trip that we ever take, and it's just the three of them. You know, so it kind of marks the trip. And so I'm a little bit deeper thinker when it comes to that stuff, but I'm excited to go and look forward to being back with you guys next week. But of course, we'll have a show for you tomorrow, but we'll be back in Starkville next week. And it has been such a pain all week long trying to get everything done, but that's what you got to do. The show must go on. Let's thank our friends at Bulldog Burger Company, longtime sponsors of this show, and we love Bulldog Burger Company. We absolutely love them, and you will love them too if you don't know who they are. Maybe you've heard the name but have never had the experience. You owe it to yourself to go put your feet under their table and let them spoil you a little bit, right? One of the main reasons you go out is just to have a great experience, not just a great meal. That's what you're going to have at Bulldog Burger Company. You know, a meal that simply can't be beat, with exemplary service and a great atmosphere at a great price. You can even have an adult beverage if you choose. It's completely up to you. Full service bar at all three of their great locations: University Drive in Stark Vegas, Gloucester Street there in Tupelo, Lake Harbor Drive in the Ridge and Flowood area. Have the spring rolls as your appetizer. They'll make you and everybody around you better looking. And find your own favorites on that menu. If you're feeling like a burger and you don't know which one to order, you can never go wrong just getting the Bulldog Burger. The signature burger of Bulldog Burger Company will make you feel like you are living life and living it more abundantly. If you're not feeling a burger and everybody else is, well, take a look around that menu. There's something for everybody. Maybe if you're trying to eat a little bit lighter, a little bit greener these days, well, get that grilled chicken salad, the BLT, very substantial portions. I have never finished it, right? And I think I'm not a big eater, but I'm above normal, I think. But nevertheless, the portion's so incredibly substantial. You're going to leave there feeling good about yourself. You're going to get, again, a great meal, and the portions are so incredibly generous. There's so many places that I go that I don't feel like I get my money's worth. That's just not the case at Bulldog Burger Company. And get that chocolate shake to go. You can ride that ride home with a smile. Bulldog Burger Company, the place for people to go to meet. M-E-A-T. All right, let's jump into the Auburn Tigers. And a real bit of a programming note, too. My friend Jason Caldwell, he and I got into the industry probably within about 3 months of each other, 30 years ago. So Auburn Undercover is leaving 247 Sports, but I want to make sure that you kind of understand what that means. Basically, the founder of Auburn Undercover, the guy that started the site when 247 Sports first became a network, he is leaving, but he has not really been involved in the day-to-day operations, and I'm not talking poorly of him. But Christian and Jason, all those guys that you have kind of come to know and love and respect on the Auburn side, they're still hanging around. And so now Auburn undercover is Auburn 247. But it's the same people that have been there all along. It's just a name change. And so I don't want you to see some social media postings and think, oh my gosh, you know, what's happened? No, everybody's fine. Everybody is fine, right? That would be just like, you know, Gene has been retired for years, and this Gene all of a sudden decided to start up another website and call it Gene's Page. Well, it doesn't change what I do. Just change the umbrella of which I work under. So we would still be with 247 Sports, but under a different name. And so I just wanted to kind of explain that because I talked to Jason today, who is my brother. Man, I love that guy. And anytime I've ever needed anything, Auburn-related or really anywhere in the state of Alabama, like if there's a recruit and he's going to a game to see an Auburn guy and there's a state guy there, he'll get me a picture and send me audio. I mean, he just looks after me. He is my brother, man. I love him. And they're heading down to Media Days and going to go to Auburn Media Days and then take their daughter to Disney for the first time. So I'm jacked for them, but there's nothing going on. The same great coverage you've gotten from our Auburn 247 site for all these years, that will continue. So let's jump into Auburn. You know, it's a brand new era. I don't know if you guys know, Hugh Freeze got fired last year. Seems to be a recurring theme. But the Tigers went 5-7. Let's kind of take a look back at last year and kind of figure out, hey, what should we expect in year one under Alex Golish? They went to Baylor, and they won that game 38-24 and actually played that game really well. I honestly picked Baylor to win that game. I just felt like, you know what? Dave Aranda and those guys defensively will find a way to kind of slow this Auburn offense down. They really didn't. Yeah, your good friend and host kind of blew that one. But, you know, Baylor actually outgained Auburn in this game. They just didn't outscore them. Baylor threw it will against an Auburn secondary, but give Auburn a lot of credit too. Once they got a lead, they shortened the game. They ran for 307 yards in this game. Yeah, and really good effort, right? And that's when everybody saw Jackson Arnold. They're like, dude, this Jackson Arnold guy's better than we thought. Didn't have a great night passing, but he was the leading rusher with 137 yards. Led all rushers with 137 yards and two touchdowns. And a couple of those were just really, really get right gains, right? Just, you know, a guy just out hustling everybody else. And so get tip of the cap to them. They win that game and you begin to think, okay, all right, I get it. Well, then you get Ball State the next week. You get that one 42-3. You get South Alabama 31-15, but it was an ugly game. But 3-0 is 3-0. They go to Oklahoma, and kind of looking back, this was a big game for Oklahoma. You bring in a ranked Auburn team, and Jackson Arnold, of course, you know, former Sooner himself, you know it's a big game for him. But, man, it was like they absolutely couldn't get anything going. And you wondered maybe, just maybe Jackson Arnold was maybe a little bit too hyped for this game, but it's 10-10 at the break. Oklahoma takes a 13-10 lead to the fourth quarter. And then you get in the fourth quarter, and all of a sudden, Auburn has taken the lead. 17-16, and then give Mateer and those guys a lot of credit. They run down and score with about 5 minutes to play to make it 22-17. And then ultimately, Jackson Arnold is sacked for a safety to cap the scoring 24-17. But, man, Auburn just absolutely could not stop putting the ball on the ground. So Oklahoma, again, FBS playoff quality defense last year. Jackson Arnold, I think that was the first time you looked at it and said, you know what, maybe he got exposed a little bit. Well, it kind of cascaded a little bit, you know, after that. Offensively, they just absolutely went in the shell. Like Oklahoma, it's like they figured out the kryptonite. Auburn goes to A&M. Again, another competitive game. And you know that A&M defense was legit. That A&M offense was very Jekyll and Hyde at times. But again, when you can't score, you can't win. Simple as that. You can't. And Auburn pulls within a field goal late, but then A&M puts it away 16-10. Again, another ugly game, but if you're the Aggies, you're like, hey, we'll take it. Absolutely you will. And A&M was number 9 team in the country. And so, again, you know, DJ Durkin and those guys were playing really good defense, but Hugh Freeze and his offense just wasn't holding up their end of the deal. You remember year one under Hugh Freeze, Auburn should have beaten Georgia. Absolutely should have beaten Georgia. And it is a rivalry game. It's not on a level of the Iron Bowl, but it is very much a rivalry game. And this is the crazy game, right? This is the game which you guys remember where Jackson Arnold fumbled, supposedly, at the goal line. And guys, it's incredible to think about this aspect of it. Like, it's a 10-0 game, and they are going in. If they score, it is 17-0 at the break against Georgia. Against a Georgia team that really needs to run the football. But instead, Georgia gets the fumble, goes down and gets a field goal to make it a 10-3 game. So rather than a 17-0 game, a three-score game, it is a one-score game. And then in the third quarter, Georgia just kind of takes over. You know, Auburn doesn't score the rest of the way. And so Georgia wins it 20-10 at Jordan-Hare. And so that brings the losing streak to 3. Then we talked about Missouri here a few shows back. Missouri wins that game in double overtime, 23-17. It's tough, man. I mean, now all of a sudden, you know, it's a 4-game losing streak all against SEC opponents. You are basically assured at this point of not having a winning record in SEC play. And, you know, that's, again, it's year 3, right? It's year 3. And those kinds of things just can't happen in year 3. You know, there's only so many excuses you can make. You know, if you don't win, you don't win. And that's the thing, too, with that's the whole thing with Hugh Freeze. It's like you're supposed to be the offensive guy, and I think in some respects the game kind of passed him by a little bit. But it's also interesting to just kind of go back and look at this, with Auburn. You know, he was fired after the 9th game of the year. And it's just kind of crazy to go back and just kind of think about, you know, what that looks like. Well, you know, we still had some time to go. They go to Arkansas and they get a dub there, 33-24. And then you just kind of felt like, you know what, hey, they're one loss away from Hugh Freeze being fired. Well, that loss came against Kentucky. And you talk about an ugly game. Kentucky wins this thing 10-3. This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp. You know, on this show, we talk about a lot of complicated issues, and you know that I'm a believer in taking care of your mental health. Just about everybody agrees that mental health should be a priority, but it still makes it tough to ask for help sometimes. BetterHelp's 2026 State of Stigma Report surveyed 2,000 Americans. They revealed that 85% of Americans believe that getting help is wise. But for some reason, about 74% say society discourages people from doing so. Don't let that happen to you. The reality of it is that sometimes we all need a little bit of a helping hand. And you can find it with BetterHelp.com. With over 30,000 therapists, BetterHelp is the world's largest online therapy platform, having served over 6 million people around the world. It works. Got an average rating of 4.9 out of 5 for a live session based on over 1.7 million client reviews. Don't let stigma stand in the way of your support in a better life. Start therapy with BetterHelp. Sign up today and get 10% off BetterHelp.com. That's Better, H-E-L-P.com. 3-3 at the break. Kentucky scores a touchdown in the third. And then everybody is shut out in the fourth. So 10-3, that's it. The Hugh Freeze era is over. And you start looking for another coach. And that's the thing. I go back and look at all this stuff, too. It's like, you know, people can say what they want to. Auburn gave Hugh Freeze every opportunity. And they were incredibly invested in that roster. And you know, there are a lot of people just, you know, after year two, you know, people are ready to move on. And so, you know, he's just not what we thought he was going to be, back-to-back losing seasons. Well, they give him year 3, and most people will because they don't want to pay that big buyout. But, you know, you have Durkin coach the team, and all, it's incredible. All of a sudden, once Freeze is out of the way, and granted, they beat Arkansas 33-24, and Arkansas had the worst defense in the conference. But all of a sudden, Freeze is gone, and all of a sudden, the offense can score. Yes, they lost at Vanderbilt 45-38, but 38 points. And again, you start looking back here, you know, with the exception of the Arkansas game, that's basically more points than they scored against the rest of the SEC. Then you put up 62 against Mercer, and you should, right? And then the Iron Bowl comes, and man, it is a absolutely competitive game again. Alabama wins it 27-20, which assured that Auburn was not going to be bowl eligible. And, I love the Iron Bowl. And the truth of the matter is that I'm kind of just like rooting against whichever team benefits Mississippi State the most, right? I'm thinking about, hopefully, about bowls. But guys, this was a 20-20 game midway through the fourth. And it was Ty Simpson kind of leading them down, making a big drive late. And I thought Auburn made Ty Simpson really nervous in that game. I mean, like, there was a lot of happy feet. But, again, the kid finds a way to make plays. They end up 5-7, and they had the opportunity to go to a bowl game. They're like, no, we're not doing this. We're not doing it. You know, middle of a coaching search, and a lot of kids going and getting in the portal, and, you know, there's just so much to deal with. So that's the way the season ended. And, again, you go back and look, Auburn's record with Hugh Freeze at the helm was 15-19. The one bowl appearance they had was in 23. They lost the Music City Bowl. And what's interesting, too, when you begin to think about, like, the Auburn – you know, the Auburn experience, like the Auburn Tigers that we grew up with, right? It was always a big deal to me, right? Auburn was always one of those teams, in many respects, in the 80s, you looked at like Alabama. You're like, you know, we're going to have a tough time winning those games. And that's really the truth. But, man, when you look at what's happened to Auburn football, and this predates Hugh Freeze. I mean, it is a rough stretch. I mean, a rough stretch. Yeah, again, when we had you expected Auburn to compete for the SEC West crown just about every year, right? I mean, it just hadn't been that way. I remember when, you know, Terry Bowden did some great things at Auburn. Been a long time ago. It has been. And so let's just kind of do the math here together. So let's start with, so they won the National Championship in 2010, right? That's the Cam Newton year, Heisman Trophy year. Next year, 8-5, then 3-9. All right, so they fire Chizik. They bring Gus back because everybody wanted Gus back. He goes 12-2 the first year and then loses the National Championship game. And you thought, okay, we're in good shape. No, you're not. Then it's 8-5, 7-6, 8-5, 10-4. In 17, 8-5, 9-4, 6-5, obviously, and they fired him after he beat us. I get sick of that. So then you bring in Brian Harsin, and Brian Harsin goes 6-7, 5-7, and then Freeze goes 6-7, 5-7, and then 5-7 on his watch, even though he didn't coach his last three games. So you have had six straight years of six or less wins. And the only winning year you had was the COVID year. They have not had a true winning record since 2019. And that was a 9-3 season when they lost the Outback Bowl. But they finished in top 15. So, again, this stretch of Auburn football I won't say it's unprecedented, but in the modern era it is. So let's take a look at this year's schedule. Kind of figure this thing out. You know, what should we expect? You know, I don't know. Now, one thing that I do know, you know, people in the industry tell me, like Alex Golish, even though he is an offensive-minded guy, he is a guy that believes in playing a very physical brand of defense. Like, it's not just, hey, we're going to go out and score everybody. So he is kind of, in that respect, maybe a modern offensive thinker, but kind of an old-school administrator where he understands the more stops you get, the better chance you have to win. So, again, kind of the the thing that made you excited about Auburn last year was defense, because they had so many young guys coming back for this year. So I expect that defense to be pretty salty. They're going to play Baylor in the Mercedes-Benz Stadium in Atlanta. They trade the home game for that. And again, that's kind of a playing a neutral site game, but let's be honest, it's going to be a home game. It just won't benefit the businesses at Auburn. But there will be a lot of money made for Auburn, and they'll be very much a partisan crowd. Then they host Southern Miss on the Plains. That should be interesting. Then they host Florida. Then homecoming against Vanderbilt. And so not a true road game until week four. And so you feel like if you're Auburn, you probably need to be 3-1 coming out of this thing. And again, you know, Baylor brings Aranda back. Going to be a neutral side game, but again, partisan crowd. That's a game you need to win. You should beat Southern Miss. The Florida thing, you just never know, right? I mean, they're going to have athletes too. You're glad that game is at home, but that's a Florida team too that also made a coaching change last year and brought in John Summerall. Vanderbilt without Diego Pavia on the Plains, you know. So there's a possibility if they get some breaks here, they could be 4-0. Before they hit the road. And then it's at Tennessee, at Georgia, and then back home to play OSU. They get the open date between Tennessee and Georgia. And of course, that you benefit from that, because Tennessee is going to be a physical game. And it's in Neyland, and you know, we'll kind of see what happens there. But then the open date, and then you got to play at Georgia. And you know, Georgia's going to be Georgia. You know, they're the standard right now that everybody's comparing themselves against. Again, then home against LSU, then to Ole Miss for Halloween. It's going to be an early game. We're going to be at Texas that night. We'll probably be driving to listen to that game. Then Auburn will host Arkansas, and then they travel to us. And so, again, you kind of break this thing down. They're going to play four straight games before they make the trip to Stark Vegas, and then they have the FCS opponent, Samford, right before the Iron Bowl. And so we don't get kind of the benefit of the sandwich game there, because, you know, but basically, you know, whoever's less than 100% won't play against Samford. But, man, wouldn't you have loved to have like another SEC opponent there, even if it's a home game? And so you don't get sandwiched in there. Not that I expect the Arkansas game to be great. I think Silverfield's going to need a year or two just to kind of get things figured out up there. But the reality of it is this is an Auburn schedule that once you get into the month of November, you feel like you can make some hay, right? You should beat Arkansas. You should. You got to travel to Mississippi State. You should beat Samford. And then you got to go to the Iron Bowl. And who knows what could happen there. And see, when you start beginning to think about what this thing could be for Golish, of course, hey, September should be a good month for Auburn. Should put you in a position that you should have a winning record and be bowl eligible. You know, the stretch, the brutal stretch is October. Three road games, and then your one home game is LSU and Lane Kiffin. Right? And I don't know how great LSU is going to be this year. The schedule, I think, is somewhat favorable. And, of course, they brought in a ton of talent. But there, you could conceivably, if you're Auburn, you could lose all four of those games. It's tough to win on the road in the SEC. And you're a first-year head coach. Yes, you've had some experience in this league before, but it's different when you're the guy running the show. And so, basically, I think Auburn will absolutely be a bowl team, but I think it's one of those deals, too, where they can ill afford to come out of September 2-2. Absolutely can't do that, because then you could conceivably be staring 2-6 in the face as you get into November. And yeah, you've got Samford, but it kind of puts you in a situation where you've got to win out to be bowl eligible. And yes, the schedule is a little bit more manageable, but again, you got two road trips in there, and who knows what everybody's going to look like by the time we play there. But the month of September is incredibly important for Auburn, not only because of the win-loss thing. You've got to cultivate some confidence in your head coach. You've got to let everybody know, hey, we made the right decision. We've hired the right guy. Look at how much better we're playing. So September needs to be no worse than 3-1. You'd love it to be 4-0, but it cannot be 2-2. Absolutely cannot be a 2-2 September, because if you do, November, the pressure is going to be on you, even though you feel like the schedule lightens up a little bit. But, man, it is a brutal stretch in October. Again, three road games in 4 weeks in October. And you do get the one open date there that helps you a little bit, kind of heal some people. But, yeah, your reward for that is then going to Georgia. So let's kind of look back here at some numbers, again, just to kind of see what Auburn looked like. And a lot of this is going to change, obviously. And if you're Auburn, you certainly hope so, because they were very anemic at times offensively last year. And again, that's why you hire Hugh Freeze, right? I mean, when Hugh was at Ole Miss and at Liberty, you know, he's always been able to score. And then you give him the benefit of a really good defense, and he still hadn't able to get it done. And, you know, we obviously have a history, but I think Auburn made a mistake hiring him in the first place. But I think at the end of the day, somebody in the league was going to give him a second chance, and Auburn did. Auburn needed to win. And it's so interesting. You go back, remember all the rumors about Lane Kiffin and Hugh Freeze kind of being the finalists there. And do you ever wonder what would have happened if Auburn had hired Lane Kiffin? Right? What would have happened then? Does Ole Miss bring Freeze back? Well, of course not. No, they don't. But it's so interesting how it works out. But again, somebody within this league was going to give Hugh Freeze a second chance. It proved to be Auburn, and it proved to be a huge mistake. It did. But offensively last year, again, you benefit from having a strong defense. They actually outgained their opponents last year about 537 yards. Average yards per play was 5.5. That's a pretty good ratio. Put up about 374 yards of offense, but only allowed 329. Outscored their opponents with 37 touchdowns to 28. Passing was, you know, a bit of a dicey proposition at times, but 362 of 220, 221 or 362. Four interceptions, just four. And then 11 for their opponents. But, again, a lot of their passing game, like average yards per attempt, was just like 6.5 yards. It wasn't like they were exactly stretching the field. And when you've kind of got a run-first quarterback, that's how it works. They did absolutely do a great job against the run last year defensively. Gave up just under 1,200 yards. So less than 100 yards a game, exactly 99.3. They outrushed their opponents by almost 1,000 yards. That's impressive. You would think, if you're controlling your run and able to run with such success, if you're doubling up your opponents, that you'd have a better season. But again, turnovers were a problem. 23 rushing touchdowns for Auburn. They allowed just a dozen. That's, yeah, it's one a game. Third down conversion, about 39%. Not terrible, not great. Defensively, much better, 35%. And then 30 sacks. For Auburn, 42 against. But it's just interesting kind of running these numbers. And again, it's indicative of a team. You look at it and say, well, they weren't always just even. You look at those numbers and you would think, hey, this team probably went, 7-5. And they probably should have, especially with the quality of that defense. And that's one thing that I heard is, Freeze is like, hey, we got this great defense coming back. Can we get another year? And it's like, yeah, but you don't coach a defense. It'll be interesting to see what happens, with this quarterback room. That's going to be probably the story of the year at Auburn. Aaron Brown makes the move from South Florida. He's a guy that knows Golish's system, and Golish knows him. And, he's put up some good numbers. Like last year, he's had two seasons where he's thrown for over 3,100 yards, including last year. 226 to 341, so right at 66%. 28 touchdowns, 7 picks. He was sacked 16 times back in 23 when he had the best throwing year of his career. He was sacked 38 times. So you're showing a little bit of the maturation of the quarterback, kind of feeling the pressure there. But they're going to be as good as he allows them to be. And, again, it benefits them a great deal, a guy that knows the system. Of course, Deuce Knight is gone, Jackson Arnold. I mean, it's all different. But, kind of looking back at the rushing aspect of it, Jackson Arnold was the second leading rusher on that team last year. And I submit to you that was probably not by design, even though You know, Hugh Freeze likes the quarterback run. He likes the quarterback that can at least make things interesting. But the guy that's probably the straw that stirs the running back room is going to be Jeremiah Cobb, a native of Montgomery, Alabama. Ran for just under 1,000 yards last year. 969 yards, a lot of that between the 20s, just 5 touchdowns last year. They didn't really utilize him a lot as a receiver. Just 11 catches out of the backfield last year. But that's a building block for you. And obviously they went out and, you know, got some guys out of the portal to kind of, you know, number one, to get your own guys in there. We've been there, right? As you guys know, we've been there recently. You know, it's one of those things that sometimes you just got to get some new faces just to kind of give you a new look, right? I mean, that's just how it all works. You just absolutely want to get new faces in there that have new energy. They're going to be excited to wear your uniform. And so kind of looking back here, incoming transfers last year for Auburn, 39. And a lot of those guys, too, you know, are guys that are your products of Power 5 programs. Even got a couple guys come in from Ole Miss, including T.J. Hedrick and Deshaun Womack have come in, playing on opposite sides of the football. But it's really much a mixed bag here. Obviously, some South Florida guys made the move to the Plains. But if you go back and look at this portal class, man, there are players from all over. You got some Oregon State guys. Remember Stanton Rammel? Remember him? Jesse Rammel's brother that was at Mississippi State for a semester, transferred to state out of the portal from James Madison. And one of the things that we're thinking is, hey, maybe we'll get his brother too. Well, Stanton Rammel, of course, eliminated Mississippi State once his brother was processed out of the program. He went to Michigan State. Well, now he's headed back to the great state of Alabama to play for Auburn. But, again, you kind of work through these numbers here. And, again, it's getting your guys in that fit your system, know your terminology. And again, a lot of USF Bulls made the move, as they are expected to. So that benefits you a great deal, but you lost a tremendous amount of talent in the outgoing lane. Eric Singleton Jr., wide receiver, highly recruited out of high school, makes the move to Florida. So that's an interesting dynamic, right? Then you've got Darrell Robinson, running back, a little bit farther down the depth chart last year, but had some play, went to Colorado State. Of course, Jackson Arnold went to UNLV to be with Dan Mullen, and Dan may know how to use him better than anybody. You know, Dan will know how to use his skill set to move the sticks. Deuce Knight, of course, transferred to Ole Miss, and it's interesting. You know, then all of a sudden, Trinidad Chambliss gets another year. Cam Coleman, we talked about him the other day. He has transferred to Texas, and it's a guy that probably maybe benefits from a change of scenery. I don't know, but he was highly touted, you know, coming out of school, out of high school. But if you look up and down the list of the Auburn transfer outs, many of them landing with Power 4 programs and probably a greater ratio than the incoming players. It's true. Kind of is what it is. But it's just significant to go back and kind of look at that aspect of it and think about this portal. Because, again, if you're like when Jeff Lebby came in, he didn't bring a lot of players with him. Signed a lot of guys out of portal, but not a lot of guys came from Oklahoma. You know, well, Golish is the head coach, obviously, so you know, you expect him with most of his staff moving along that you would probably have, you know, a great number of players make the trip. And I think that's one of the things that helps when you get a sitting head coach rather than a coordinator. And that's not to be critical of anybody. That's just kind of the reality of life. Guys don't always follow coordinators. They do follow coaches, head coaches. Looking at the Auburn signing class last year, and it's, you know, 21st in the country. You know, what does that kind of play out to be? You know, Corey Wells, a guy that we really liked a lot, flipped from Texas to Auburn. Of course, you know, State took Brother Womack from them. You know, so it's interesting kind of looking at some of these names again. Parker Pritchett was a guy that we felt pretty good about early on from Carver, but, you know, he has to basically pass Auburn from Columbus, Georgia, on the route to Starkville. Once Auburn got involved, it was pretty much assumed he was going to be a Tiger. But, yeah, I mean, some good players. And it's so interesting, too. Auburn signed Corey Wells and his younger brother, Chris Wells, to keep them together. Now, that's a good recruit. It truly is. But it's going to be defensive-minded, as it should be. But in addition to that, too, I think offensively, because of the pieces coming in that are familiar with Golish's expectations, terminology, and just his culture, I think Auburn probably sees a turnaround maybe a little quicker than some others. That's, the whole benefit of getting the sitting head coach, because you basically bring a staff en masse and don't have to kind of piece one together, and you get enough recruits to transfer with you that can be basically de facto assistants in their personnel groups and say, oh, no, this is what coach wants. This is how we do this. When you don't have those guys that know your system, then everybody is learning. The assistant coaches are learning. The players are learning. Then the head coach and his group are kind of learning everybody else. And so, again, it's the better course of action 9 times out of 10 is to go get the sitting head coach. And that's what Auburn has done. And what's interesting, too, like, all these media reports that Golish was going to go to Arkansas. Remember that? One thing I was told is that he had initially kind of given them a preliminary thumbs up at Arkansas, and it leaked out. And Golish backed out of the deal and said, I can't trust those guys. And then goes to Auburn. And then Arkansas has to pivot and go get Ryan Silverfield from Memphis. And so that's one of those things, too, I think maybe speaks to the character of Golish a little bit, too. That, yeah, this is a chance for me to go get a great job at Arkansas and that they're ready to put some money behind football. But when I make a tentative agreement with those guys, we hadn't signed a contract. We're like, hey, let's do business together. And then somebody on their side of the fence kind of betrays your trust. I think that says a little bit about him. And maybe there's a little more than meets the eye with this Alex Golish guy. Maybe that kind of character will carry over into the quality of their football program as they begin to kind of move forward. All right, time for today's top 10 list, brought to you by closewithblair.com. That's C-L-O-S-E with Blair, B-L-A-I-R.com. Blair Chandler is my friend, your friend, our collective friend in the mortgage industry. Let me make sure you've got his number since we're all friends. 601-500-2344. 601-500-2344. 500-2344. Save that as mortgage guy. You may forget the name, you won't forget the need, and you already have his number. Save you a lot of time and effort, you know. And what's so interesting about Blair, he's been doing this for 25 years. A lot of people kind of getting started in this industry. I don't know if you can entrust your mortgage to just anybody. Life is too important. Building generational wealth is important. Having roots are important. So stick with a winner. Stick with Blair Chandler. He is a bulldog through and through, but he does not discriminate. I know that we have listeners from other fan bases that check in from time to time to listen. Blair could help you too. Licensed to practice in multiple states. So whether it's your first home, your next home, your retirement home, or perhaps that game day condo that you have so coveted, maybe perhaps Blair can make that dream of ownership come true for you. Be sure and check him out today at closewithblair.com. All right. Vacation day tomorrow. Not sure what we do top 10. I've got a few requests. I'll sort through them and figure out. But I thought today we'll do vacation songs. Top 10 vacation songs. And, you know, we're heading down to the Redneck Riviera. Maybe we'll see you there. And we're excited to go. Really excited to go. And so what's exciting about it to me, it's not just the chance to get out of town and just kind of unwind a little bit, even though I'll probably do some work while I'm down there because that's just how I'm wired, but it's just being with my kids and grandkids. I'm making memories with the people that I love the most. I encourage you guys to do that as often as you can too. But the ride down there will be fun. Probably the Rook games or Trivial Pursuit or whatever they decide to play will be fun. Meals will be fun. Hanging out, playing with the grandkids will be fun. And one of the funnest things for me is to see my kids play with the grandkids. Like to see my grandkids, aunts and uncle, spend time with them. And it doesn't just make for good Facebook content. It's kind of chicken soup for the soul, as they say. So here we go. Top 10 vacation songs. Number 10, we are going to the beach. So Seals and Crofts, Summer Breeze. It makes me feel fine. And it's very much an adult contemporary song. It's not really a rock song. Number 9, this one is a rock song. Off the Nothing Shocking album. It's Juana's Addiction, Summertime Rolls. Yeah, that's Jane's Addiction for you English-speaking folks. Jane's Addiction. I do enjoy Jane's Addiction. It was so much fun when they hit the scene. It was a different vibe, different scene. It was fun, even though some of the subject matter is very serious. Number eight is Sheryl Crow, who we love. Former Michael Jackson backup singer. Now an accomplished singer-songwriter in her own regard. We're going to soak up the sun while we're down there. Hopefully we don't get sunburned. I'm sure we will a little bit. But we're going to follow Sheryl Crow's instructions. Number 7, a lot of people like to go with beautiful girls here, but I'm a married man. Not that I won't look, but we're going to go with a song that we had it on the show here recently. It's Summer Nights from 5150 for the Van Hagar era. I like that album. I know some other people are like, oh, it's not the same without Dave. Quit being a gatekeeper. There were some great tunes. I thought Eddie did some of his best work with Sammy as a vocalist. I thought, number one, Sammy's a better vocalist than Dave. May not be the same showman. But Summer Nights is one of those deeper cuts in the Van Halen catalog you should probably know. Number 6, in many respects, this was... maybe, if I'm being honest with you guys, my gateway album into Aerosmith. Like, I knew who Aerosmith was. I respected them. I liked the hits, but I had never bought an Aerosmith album until Permanent Vacation came out. And I love that song. I love that album from start to finish. Of course, that's got Dude Looks Like a Lady and Ragdoll and Hearts Done Time is a great one, too. But Permanent Vacation is a lot of fun, too. The percussion on it is great. After I bought this, I went back and bought Done With Mirrors, and next thing you know, it's Get Your Wings and Aerosmith One, and you know, you got to go up and buy them all. And I have. Number 5, I love this track, and it's off the Lost Boys soundtrack. I absolutely love this song when the first time I heard it, and the fact that it makes me so nostalgic about Lost Boys kind of helps, but it's NXS with Jimmy Barnes, Good Times. Great track. Great track. And if you know the movie, you know when they play it, how incredible it was. Number 4, we talked about Sheryl Crow earlier. Well, now it's her ex that she sang a duet with Picture. It's Kid Rock's All Summer Long. Of course, he samples Warren Zevon's Werewolves of London, and it works in some Lynyrd Skynyrd too. It's just a good time and track. Number 3, one of the main reasons you take a vacation is just to kind of relax a little bit and take it easy. So we're going to let the Eagles kind of serenade us along the way there. It's a great song. Don't let the sound of your own wheels drive you crazy, right? What great, great lyrics and words for living. Number 2, and how could we put a vacation list together without featuring the Go-Go's? I'll be honest with you. I mean, just, you know, between us. I never really had a big crush on the Go-Go's. Now, the Bangles, completely different. Bananarama, absolutely. Not so much. Belinda Carlisle's a beautiful woman, don't get me wrong. I just never really felt like that was the big deal for me. Love the Bangles. Love them. Love them all. Some more than others. But Vacation from the Go-Go's. What a great video, too. Great video. It was a lot of fun. The Go-Go's were a lot of fun, too. And then number 1, I always think about the vacation movies. I love the Chevy Chase catalog. I do. I love the vacation movies. I wish they would do another one. I know they rebooted a few years back, and it was Rusty taking his family for a vacation. And maybe we'll watch that at some point. We haven't yet. But, you know, of course, the first Vacation movie was incredible. European Vacation was great, too. Vegas Vacation was good, pardon me. But the thing that I go back to is Holiday Road from Lindsey Buckingham. And how, my, number one, how fun the song was. But also, too, how it fits so well on the trip to Wally World. And we're not going to Wally World, but we are taking a vacation. And I don't think we see Chrissy Brinkley on the way either. But you never know. But yeah, I love those old movies. And how could you not love Beverly D'Angelo? And just the humor, the incredible comedic timing and humor of that cast. It was so incredibly relatable. There were so many of us, we wished like our parents were more like them, right? But some of the memories and the things that can go wrong on vacation kind of rang true for us. And so that was an important aspect of it. And if you grew up a kid in the 80s, you knew that when Chevy Chase was in a movie, it was going to be incredibly funny. Of course, Saturday Night Live alum Chevy Chase. But I think the Vacation series was probably one of those things that kind of marks our teenage years in a lot of respects. So Holiday Road it is. And I may even surprise Dana and like put that track on. When we get in the vehicle and get ready to roll, I may just put it on just to kind of set the mood. That's your top 10 list for today. Again, not sure what we're going to go with tomorrow, but that's your vacation list. Maybe you can use it as well. If you have ideas for the top 10 list, reach out, let us know. Best way to do that is to hit up my friend, Roy Simonte, on X at Dogmatic67. And you can find our great list on Spotify under that same handle. Sometimes we get a little bit behind, but we will get them up there for you. Eventually, and we do push those things out on Twitter as well. But you never know. You may have a great idea. We will use it on the show. If you want credit, we'll give you credit. You know, it's an interactive show, and we appreciate your contributions, and thank you so much for your support of the Boneyard all these many years. All right, next segment of the show brought to you by Campus Bookmart, a Starkvillian institution. Man, we love Campus Bookmart. We do. We love them. We love them. Why do we love them? Well, they got the things we want, right? There's a lot in life that can be complicated. Buying a gift for a Mississippi State fan shouldn't be. Just buy more Bulldog merch. You'll be the hit of the birthday party, the bridal shower, whatever. Just buy Mississippi State merch. So if you're looking for apparel or gift ideas or decorative items to detail out your fan cave, your home, your RV, your pet, whatever, you can find it at Campus Bookmart. Miss Kathy Brown does an amazing job outfitting that store with the best in Mississippi State wares. Now, next time you're in Starkville, go by and see their smiling faces. It's right there off of 182. Like you make that turn by the Trooper Station, just kind of mosey on around towards campus, and boom, there's Campus Bookmart right there on the left. Plenty of parking. Yeah, be sure and check it out. And go in and buy something for yourself. If you can't make it to town, or perhaps game day is a difficult shopping day for you, visit them on the World Wide Web, courtesy of Al Gore's internet at campusbookmart.net. And by being a loyal Boneyard listener, we'll give you a phrase that pays, and that is BSR, which stands for Beautiful Steve Robertson. That gets you free shipping on all orders over $75. Any order less than 75 bones, absolutely incomplete. All right. We broke some news yesterday as former UCLA pitcher Landon Stump is headed to Mississippi State. That's been rumored for a while, and there was some fire to that smoke. And he wanted to kind of wait out the draft. He said, hey, he kind of was telling some teams, like, I'm going to go to Mississippi State, kind of figure this thing out. But he kind of wanted to wait through the draft because you never know, right? I mean, you never know what somebody may offer you. But yes, he pitched against us out in Arlington. Yeah. So he went 2-1 last year and 18 games, 13 starts. He could be a spot starter. He can be a reliever. He is coming in trying to compete for a weekend spot. That's going to be tough sledding. But this is a young man, too, that can help you in a variety of ways. But he has been primarily a starter. And that's the thing you begin to think about, too. It's like it's so difficult to make it through the season with the same weekend rotation. There's always somebody that has, you know, a little tenderness, or, you know, maybe they get a blister, and it gives you some flexibility to have a guy that has starting experience that if you need to rest a guy, you can. One of the more underappreciated things that I would say about Stump, 179 innings pitched in college. With John Savage, one of the best coaches in the country, and certainly one of the guys that develops pitchers as well as anybody. So not only is he thrown a lot of college innings, he has done so under the supervision of one of the best developers of pitchers in the college game. And now we will have the opportunity to benefit from that. That is an important aspect of this. An experienced guy. Guys, old wins in college athletics. That's just how life is. Every so often you run across somebody that's, you know, a young whippersnapper that can come in there and do some special things for you, like a Jacob Parker. But primarily, that's the exception rather than the rule. You want guys that have been there and done that. Now, you're kind of looking back here at Stump's numbers. 18 appearances, 13 starts. He threw 54.2 innings, allowed 48 hits, so less than a hit per. Allowed 25 earned runs, struck out 43, walked 22. So that's about 2-1. That's got to get better. And then the batting average against was 241. But gave up 6 tanks this year, which that's not a terrible number by any stretch. But it's one of those things that you want to be able to work down. And he is a guy, too, that has a variety of pitches. I will have a scouting report up for your Friday reading pleasure. But, I don't know sometimes when I look at some of these numbers, like, and I'm kind of an old school coach too. I just wonder, maybe sometimes we're trying to do too much. Fastball, slider, cutter, change, curveball. 5 pitches. And sometimes when you're trying to master 5, then even the 4th and 5th pitch kind of get sideways a little bit on you. A lot of guys like to work with a 3-pitch mix, but when you can throw strikes, you throw whatever you want. And the strike ratio is very, very good. But this is a guy, again, you're going mid-90s with the fastball that comes in a low release angle, got some vertical run to it, and can get guys to chase. The slider is not just a wipeout pitch. It can be thrown for a strike. The cutter, another one. Throwing strikes better than 50% of the time. The changeup is good and really gets down the slope there, so it looks like a fastball until the point of release. You get guys out on their front foot. And then there's the curveball, which is thrown with a little less frequency. Doesn't spin it exceptionally well. But it's a pitch that's under development and probably needs to be better utilized against left-handers. So, again, a great get for Mississippi State. And now we're done with pitching, okay? We are done with pitching. I still think Mississippi State could add a utility guy, maybe a younger bat. We'll see, because we lost 3 position players from our signing class to the draft, and then Aiden Teal gets drafted and is expected to sign. So you may be in a scenario where you need to get a position player. I don't think you need to, but if you can find 2 that can really help you, that would be beneficial. I just don't know if there's enough value. That's the thing you begin to look at. Like the Martin Shewer thing, too, wasn't just because of the Red Sox. When you begin to think about, State has gotten 3 outfielders from the portal, and you bring Jacob Parker back. And so that's something to consider, too. It's kind of a crowded outfield if you're a portal guy. And you begin to wonder, is there a Drew Weyers type out there? This year, let's be honest, beginning of the year, most of us thought at some point Jacob would break into the starting lineup, and he did, and became a freshman All-American. But if you go back and remember, in the first few weeks of the season, James Nunnally was playing right and leading off. Aiden Teal was playing center, and Bryce Chance was in left. Well, that's not at all how we ended up the year. Bryce goes to center, Valenkis goes to left, Parker stays in right. And eventually, about halfway through the year, we stopped platooning Parker and Valenkis. And then as Teal got banged up, and God help him, You know, Aiden Teal, I don't know if we ever really saw him at 100% after the first month of the season because he had this multiple injuries, and especially with the foot. And the kid wants to play, and I absolutely wish him the best. But you can't count on that, right? If you're a outfielder transferring in, and it looks like, hey, Mississippi State's already got a bunch of outfielders, I may want to go somewhere else and play to ensure that I play to give myself a chance to get drafted. Now, with the new commitment, which was the 27th best player in the portal, we pretty much stayed where we were. And again, we kind of run it down. State is sixth in the portal. And some of these algorithms and calculations sometimes don't make a lot of sense, but trust me, there's no bias in this stuff. I mean, you look at it and say, well, Vanderbilt's got 9 players and only 6 in the top 50, and they're just right behind State, who has 13 overall and 9 in the top 250. So, you know, that's something you consider. And then again, you just added a guy that was 27th. So another top 50 player, you would think that maybe we would overtake somebody. But when you begin to look at this, you know, South Carolina thing, tiny, tiny high school class because they brought in all these guys from Coastal. 23 players. Not all from Coastal, but 23 players coming in. And, you know, Tyler Pitzer, of course, transferred out there and then signed a free agent deal. So he will not be part of South Carolina's class. So once these transfers, those that are going to sign, and we've been through that before too. You know, we didn't have any of our transfer guys sign. Arkansas did. So we'll see how that kind of plays out. So it'll be interesting. There may be some ebb and flow with all of that. You know, maybe we can creep into the top 5 and stay there. But I don't think it needs to be a goal of ours to go out and sign the number one transfer portal class in the country. You know, you go fit the guys to fit your culture and your system, and they may not be the most high-rated guys, but they're guys that fit what you want. As you guys know, you know, LSU, of course, last year just kind of had a bum portal class. And that's kind of what happens when you begin to run through this, when you're so reliant on a portal. And you look at LSU now, just 8 guys in the portal. And there's some good guys that are coming in there. And they're the number one rated portal class in the country. And 8 players leave, they bring in 8. All 8 are top 250 guys. And so, yeah, it makes a little sense there. But again, it's a smaller portal class for LSU, which kind of brings me to my next point, too. I've got an article coming out on Friday about, you know, what everybody is facing from a high school signee draft situation. And so that'll be a free piece. You can check that over Gene's page. People always ask for that. Hey, Steve, what did everybody lose? Well, LSU and Vanderbilt lost the most, as they should, because they oversign dramatically every year. You know, it's like, hey, if we go out here and we sign, you know, 16 guys that are draft risk and we just get half of those guys to come to campus, well, that's 8 guys that were MLB draft risk that are on our roster now. And so we do some of that too. We're a little more measured in how we do it. But Vandy and LSU historically have gone out and really been aggressive signing high school guys and just kind of figuring it out as they go. And so kind of, you know, again, there will be some adjustment in these rankings once guys sign their pro contracts. But right now, Mississippi State, number 6 in the country, when it comes to high school commitments. But again, there will be some adjustments in every bit of that because of the fact that, of course, we've had 3 of our high school signees that have been drafted. And so that will, we had 4 actually. Dent Lord's already on campus though. But that's part of the deal too. And so there will be some adjusted, like, reporting rankings. And that could be a scenario where State actually blossoms a little bit there too. Because looking back at the LSU thing here, I think it's important to see this. So LSU had 23 commits from high school. 23. We had 14. 23 commitments, and then 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 of those guys get drafted. Now, a couple of those guys are going to come to school. Right? There's a couple of guys who were just kind of drafted late. It's kind of a skip pick. I think I've told you guys how that all works. you know, a team has to make a pick, and when you've run out of bonus pool money, you go draft a guy that you know is going to sign. Maybe just to have a conversation or just kind of work your way through it. Vanderbilt, number one recruiting class in the country with 23 players. Vanderbilt is one. LSU is two, again with 23. So, again, let's look at the Vanderbilt results from the draft. And, again, it's comparable to LSU. Eric Booth played at from Bassfield, played at Oak Grove, number seven pick in the draft, right? So, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 8 for Vanderbilt. So, the majority of those guys are expected to sign. There's a couple that were 15-rounders that we expect to come to school. But when it's all said and done, when you begin to do these adjustments, you'll see some guys obviously sign pro deals, and then there's an adjustment how things work. You know, Tennessee's in a similar situation too. You know, Tennessee right there with the third class. It's not quite as big because they don't need to be, right? You know, looking at Tennessee's numbers, they had 18 commitments. And then they have two first-rounders, a second-rounder, and then fifth and 11th. So they have five guys, and four of those five will certainly sign, and we'll see what happens with Cody Boschel, the first baseman, who's drafted in the 11th round. And so, again, that's another team that could see some adjustments. And, again, they're just ahead of Mississippi State. You look at Texas, and, again, it's Texas, right? And they got a big budget. They can compete. 22 high school commitments. So they oversigned two. And they have, you know, first rounder. Grady Emerson, right? For those of you that kept up with the draft. Yeah, he was a Texas signee. And then you kind of work your way through it. They have, you know, four of their guys. So it could be a scenario when the dust settles, Texas may actually bring the number one class once it's adjusted. You know, Wake Forest is right there just above us with 17 commitments, and you look at average player stuff, but they only had the one kid drafted in the third round. So, you know, they may stay ahead of us. I suspect they will when you consider our losses. But when it's all said and done, Brian O'Connor bringing a top 10 portal class, potentially a top five one, to campus, and bringing a top 10, potentially top five class on the high school side. So the talent is coming in at Mississippi State. And then as you begin to think about what you're returning, and I've got an article on that too, and that's going to be a VIP piece for just kind of let you guys know kind of what's out there already about next year's draft class. And, again, obviously the weekend rotation is going to be a big part of that. But it's important that you guys know that. We are going to continue to have draft concerns every year with high school signees, more so than probably we've had in recent years, but we're going to bring a lot of those guys to campus. Again, this year you had eight guys go to the combine from the high school signing class, and five of those eight are now at Mississippi State. Yeah, so again, it's kind of the LSU-Vanderbilt model, but on a more measured scale. And so Brian O'Connor knows what he's doing. He doesn't need you or I to tell him how to manage his recruiting practices, but I think we can discuss it among ourselves, and we can kind of see there is a method to the madness. And he said from the beginning, you know, he really doesn't want to be so incredibly portal reliant. And I think maybe some of that kind of came from ACC quality thinking. I think when you get here and you see how competitive everybody is in the portal every single year trying to upgrade their rosters, I think you kind of have to adjust a little bit. But I don't think we'll ever see him kind of be maybe what LSU, Georgia, and Kentucky have been every single year, you know, chasing a ton of portal guys. But, you know, Brian wants to win the NAFL championship just like you and I do. And so if that means that, hey, we've got to kind of recalibrate a little bit, maybe sign a few more portal guys than we're accustomed to at Virginia, that's what he's going to do. All right, final segment of the show brought to you by the Stark Vegas Clubhouse, the best place to stay in the Golden Triangle, bar none, especially when you're bringing a larger group to town, and you should. We stayed there before. We had a blast. You will too. Very easy to find out past the Highlands off 182. It's the old renovated Country Club Clubhouse, renovated with you in mind, and good times. A lot of peace and quiet out there. Now, Google the Stark Vegas Clubhouse. When you do, their Facebook page will pop up for you. You can check out all the pictures of the amenities available to you and your guests, the full-service kitchen, the wet bar, the back porch area, the fire pit area, plenty of parking, which is an underrated amenity. A lot of guests coming. Sometimes you don't know where everybody's going to park. You don't have to worry about your car getting towed because you got plenty of parking, right? You see a lot of golfers out there playing 18. So you could get out there and enjoy yourself. And, you know, what the cool part about it is, too, it's just 5 minutes away from the Mississippi State campus. So if it's a ball game weekend, you do your tailgating right there. Save yourself a little time and effort later. Now, when you do that Google search, you're going to have some booking options pop up, too. Airbnb, VRBO, or Vrbo, however you want to pronounce it. But if you want to save some money, book through the Evolve website and use promo code BSR10. That's BSR10. Get you 10% off your stay just by listening to this show. The Stark Vegas Clubhouse, best place to stay in the Golden Triangle. All right, Team USA with a couple of Bulldogs, Ryan McPherson and Tomas Valencias, has wrapped up their tour in Europe. And Tico, 4 innings, 1 hit, no runs, 6 Ks, and 1 walk. And the USA takes a 2-0 lead into the 7th. Japan ties it 2-2. And I don't know if you guys have seen this. It's ridiculous. Gary Pack Jr., or Anthony Pack, pardon me. Anthony Pack from Texas, who was SEC Freshman of the Year in the eyes of some people, not ours, but some. With 2 out and 2 on in the 9th, he makes a diving catch to give the U.S. a chance to walk it off in the 9th. We don't, and then USA gives up 1 in the top of the 10 to give Japan a 3-2 lead. The American team ties it in the bottom of the 10th, and then we ultimately lose 6-3 as we allow 3 runs in the bottom of the 11th inning. And so a silver medal for Team USA, very successful trip. And how great is it to see some Bulldogs go over there? Ryan and Tico both pitch very well. We'll give you a wrap-up tomorrow at Gene's page, too, just kind of detailing it all out for you. But, yeah, I mean, it's an honor to represent your country, and it's an honor to go over there and you know, get to take an amazing trip. And so we're happy that our guys are headed back home, and we wish they were conquering heroes, but we could not be more proud of them. And, of course, both of those guys forecasted to be first-rounders and next year's Major League Baseball draft. But before they get to that point, we're going to go chase a national championship at Duty Noble Field this year. We hope that you'll come out and be in attendance with every bit of that. And I don't know if you guys have seen the Rules Committee now allowing ABS in regular season games. I think this is a great thing. I know some people are against it. There's some baseball purists like, you know, like the human aspect of it. But, man, at Hoover, man, it was like over 50% of the challenges were correct. And so, again, it helps the officials kind of modify the strike zone to make sure that we get a true and accurate zone. But also, too, it gives pitchers, catchers, hitters the chance to appeal a call, and the rules will be in place. Now, not everybody has the technology to pull off ABS. We do at Duty Noble Field. We do. We have Hawkeye. Most everybody in the SEC does. And so we'll use that technology, and now we'll have ABS in regular season games. I think it's a great thing. That's my feeling about it, and I'm eager to see what else comes out of the meeting this week. I don't know what else has been handed down, but we'll be watching that this weekend and kind of keeping up with all that stuff. The meeting may be over by now. But Billy O'Connor, of course, the head coach, Xavier, the head of the Rules Committee, and Tim Corbin went and represented the Southeastern Conference along with SEC Baseball Associate Commissioner Matt Boyer. So I'm confident that we were incredibly well represented there. And there'll probably be some changes to some other rules that will be beneficial to everybody as well. As we get ready to wrap up, too, I wanted to talk to you guys a little bit about Monday. You know, recorded Monday's show on Sunday evening because I had to get up early and drive down south to Poplarville, Mississippi. As some of you that follow me on socials, you already know. If you're over at jeanspage.com, you know. But so I had to appear in court as the plaintiff, as I petitioned the court to get a certificate of rehabilitation and to have my Second Amendment rights restored. And we were successful in that petition. There are a few things that I wanted to talk about with the actual proceedings. I thought, number one, the court itself was very well run. Folks down in Poplarville in that district did a really good job. A lot of times you go to court and there's a lot of wasted time. I thought they were pretty efficient in what they did. And of course, you get there, and I was supposed to be there at 11, and I text one of my attorneys and said, it'll be about 10:45. He goes, hey, no rush. They're still calling the 9:30 docket. So when I get there, there's all of these prisoners, you know, in their yellow jumpsuits and striped jumpsuits and things like that over there to the right. And I don't know if you're supposed to sit with those folks, so I didn't. I didn't want anybody to think I was trying to pass some contraband. But you can't wear your hat in there and you can't bring your phone. So that kind of crapped my style a little bit. But it brought back some memories of, you know, when I was that person. Now, when I went to court, of course, I was on bond and, you know, dressed in a suit and that kind of stuff. And I remember one of the assistant DAs told me, he said, you're the best looking dressed person I've ever seen to plead guilty. You know, a lot of times people show up in blue jean cutoff shorts and legalized marijuana T-shirt and say, you know, they're guilty. But anyway, I think it's important to have respect for the court and for the proceeding itself. It is a very serious undertaking. There was one particular instance that kind of jumped out to me. It was a young man chose to represent himself in a seizure case. He had been stopped and found to have narcotics in his vehicle. And all of that was a little bit muddy too, right? There was a lot of talk about, well, they said he ran a stop sign, but the police officer who facilitated the stop could not have seen the stop sign at the intersection. And then later they said, well, I got behind him and there was a careless operation or whatever. He crossed the middle line. And, you know, I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. But nevertheless, they stopped him and he did have narcotics. And it really wasn't a lot of narcotics. They made it seem like it was, as a guy that used to do narcotics and trade in that industry, I can tell you it wasn't a lot of narcotics. And it could have easily been passed off as his personal use. But you know, they had to stop, and they said, well, they smelled marijuana. And as our Harvard law dog, Mia Robertson, says, I talked to her about this case, and she said, they always smell marijuana, bro. Yeah, they do. And what's interesting is the guy admitted to being a marijuana smoker, but said he had not been smoking in the vehicle at that time because he had his child with him. And, of course, they had to make arrangements for the child to get picked up by a relative as he got arrested. And it's also unsettling. But the advice that I have to you, no matter how smart you think you are, and of course I'm sitting there thinking, if I'm representing this guy, I mean, we're going to be here all day because I'm going to challenge the constitutionality of the stop. I'm going to challenge the constitutionality of the seizure and the search, every bit of it, you know. And but he didn't. And what happened ultimately is he had $2,000 in his wallet, and he said he'd just gotten paid. Now, of course, maybe he didn't. Maybe he got paid, and he even made a comment that if it was drug money, it'd be ones, fives, and tens. So, of course, they ask him, well, how would you know that? Well, of course, you know, that's a question, too. We can even ask if that's even admissible. But the reality of it is, do not try to represent yourself. Because, again, I think there was some flaws in the DA's case, and ultimately, the seizure stood, and he lost like $2,000, and he kept saying, well, it was actually more than that, and they actually took some of the money. It's illegal. They gave some of the seizure to my relative to babysit my child. That's illegal. That's stupid. I mean, like, law enforcement's trying to throw you a solid here. You've been arrested. You've got to make arrangements to have your child taken care of, and they're going to let some of the what they believe are your ill-gotten gains go to pay this person. They're showing you some grace and mercy. Don't show up in court and try to poke holes in that and saying they violated the law. And technically, maybe they did, but they're trying to be well-intended here. But you can go to court and look like an absolute clown if you want to. I would encourage you not to. Get legal representation for anything, right? It doesn't matter how minor a thing you think it may be. Get representation. And if you can't afford a lawyer, you have a constitutional right through Miranda to have a lawyer appointed for you. And even though some of these PDs may not be F. Lee Bailey, they're still lawyers. They're going to know part and procedure a lot better than you. So no matter what you think, you may think you're smarter than the DA, and you know what? You may be. But you don't know the protocol of a legal proceeding. Just because you watch Law & Order and Dateline NBC doesn't mean that you're capable of defending yourself, and you're trying to get back $2,000 of what you believe is your hard-earned cash. Half a loaf is better than no loaf, right? No bread at all, right? So if you had a lawyer, even if you had to pay them $1,000 and you win that seizure case, you're going to get half your money back. And I think that case probably could have been litigated a little bit better. So I share that with you because I see these people. And one of the things that really stuck with me too is how many of these people, how many of them are struggling with addiction. And it's a very common tale, right? I mean, people get involved in addiction. And, you know, this one lady got up there and she talked about how she had been improperly touched as a child. And that's a common story. And then ultimately that led to some abuse issues, and she kind of sought relief through narcotics. And it became a big problem in her life. And then there was another guy. You know, he had had some challenges in his life and was arrested on narcotics charges. And some of the charges that I heard were very serious. And so it got to be my turn. And we were the next to last to go. And I was okay with that, right? I mean, you know, these other people, of course, they got to get them back to the jail, right? They got to get them back for lunch. And, you know, there's a lot to that. So we were the next to last to go. And I stood up, and before I even said anything, you know, they had to go get the DA because the state had left, and had to go back and get them, bring them back. And to be bluntly honest with you, they were kind of unprepared. Not that there was much to prepare for, but they were, and had to go pull all the stuff up and everything else. And ultimately, they did not oppose the ruling. And so the judge asked me a couple of questions, and he just said, you know, hey, you want to go hunting or whatever? I said, you know, it's not even just that. It's not that. Sure, that's part of it, but it's not just that. It's that I have lived my life for nearly 35 years now as a law-abiding citizen. I have done the best that I possibly can to help other people, namely with addiction and depression and things of that nature. I have done my best to be an advocate for the still suffering addict. I have spoken extensively with people in state government about laws about addiction and narcotics. Things of that nature. I have done my absolute best to use my experiences to help other people. And I shared that with the judge. I said, I have traveled around this country, and I have spoken with families and young people and spoken at conventions and things of that nature. This is in no way to blow me up, but I'm just trying to make sure you understand I learned my lesson, and I have more respect for this court than most people would ever appreciate. Because Judge Michael Eubanks, who used to sit on that bench, and he died a year or two ago, in some respects, he saved my life. And that sounds kind of crazy, but it's true. Because when I went to court and pled guilty and was ultimately sentenced, I had already pled guilty. I went back for sentencing, and on January 24th, 1992, he could have remanded me to custody. He could have. I'd already pled guilty. And my attorney spoke up and said, Your Honor, we ask that Mr. Robertson be allowed to complete his drug rehabilitation. And Judge Michael Eubanks could have easily said no, but he didn't. He gave me a chance to go back. And to be honest with you, in the beginning of my recovery, I was just kind of dogging it. I really wasn't committed to it. Because to be bluntly honest with you guys, the main reason that I went to rehab was to get my family off my back and to try to look good for a judge. That's me being honest. That was my intention when I went to drug rehabilitation. It wasn't to get better. It wasn't to quit doing drugs. I had no intention of stopping drinking and drugging when I went to rehab. Everybody always talks about the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking or using. Well, I didn't even qualify to go to the meetings because I didn't have the desire to stop. But after that day when I was sentenced, and there was even some craziness with that stuff too, because the ADA, Kathy Soans, was unaware that we had struck a plea bargain deal that encompassed all of my charges. And when she found out that we had other charges, she was like, "We weren't aware of this." And my lawyer said, "Well, your boss was. And he's the one that made the deal." And Judge Michael Eubanks said, "Well, you know, I'm going to sentence him based on this." They could have easily said, "You know what, we're going to withdraw the deal." But Judge Michael Eubanks held them accountable for that. And I'm very fortunate. But when I went back to Pine Grove that day, people didn't think they were ever going to see me again. They did not realize that I was going to come back. And it was after that sobering moment in court, when I was facing 40 years in the state penitentiary, that I was given a second chance. And that's when I got serious about, you know what, this is not going to lead me anywhere promising. And so I've got to change my life. And I did. And I'm still here to tell you the story. I have not had a drink or drug since December 10th, 1991. And I am a MDOC success story. I learned my lesson. I got close enough to the fire to understand I didn't want to get burned. And I turned my life around. And so I told the judge some of those things. And I said, at the end of the day, I just want a piece of my life back that I lost way back then. And he looked at me and he smiled. And it was so interesting. One of the guys that was there in court, I don't know what their position was, but I heard him off to the right and he goes, "You know, that's the writer, right?" And the judge said, "Mr. Robertson, I want you to know it is my honor to give this back to you. And so now I have this certificate of rehabilitation. I have the right to bear arms within the state of Mississippi. And of course, I have been inundated with many of you that have felony convictions too." And it's like, "Dude, what do I do?" Well, you know, go hire a lawyer. Again, don't try to represent yourself. But I shared that with you because I had a conversation with Mia. She is one of the ones, there's probably nobody in my life that has encouraged me more to pursue this than she has. And she even wrote a paper about this when she was in college at State, about how I got in trouble when I was 19 years old. And in many respects, I have served a life sentence. And if we're really serious about rehabilitating people, there has to be a light at the end of the tunnel. I was a nonviolent offender who was a drug addict that checked into rehab at 6'2", 146 pounds. I was a mess. And up until Monday, I was still paying for that. Still paying for it. And as Mia says, "Daddy, it's not just about getting your right to bear arms back. It's about getting your dignity back. Even if you never decide to go hunting, you can. Whereas all these years, for 30 plus years, you have been excluded from that group, despite the fact that you have led such a great life and tried so hard to help other people." And the judge told me, he said, "In the 4 years that I've been on the bench, this is the only one of these I've ever approved." He says, "Typically, it's some guy that's, you know, a year out of jail that wants to get his guns back, you know." He goes, "I've never had anybody wait 30 plus years." And the truth of the matter is, as I told you guys, my life is not going to change either way. I may go deer hunting with some of you guys now, and that'll be fun because I haven't been able to do that since I was a kid. I hadn't been able to do it. because you can't run the risk of getting caught with a weapon as a convicted felon, because guess what? You go right back to prison. You do. And so that's an important aspect of this for me, is that I no longer feel excluded from certain activities any longer. Right? People are like, hey, can you vote again? I've never been unable to vote. I've been able to vote the whole way through because I was a nonviolent offender, you know. And, you know, goodness, these days, they'll let anybody vote, right? Probably getting mail-in votes from the prisoner anyway. But my point being in every bit of this is that if you have been in trouble earlier in your life and you have led a good life since then, and you have not broken the law, and you have been a great husband and a great father and a business leader in your community, and you have been an advocate for those that suffer, you shouldn't have to suffer the rest of your life for a mistake you made when you were a teenager. You shouldn't. And so if you are in those positions, I would encourage you to pursue this, even if you never have any plans. But now, your good friend and host, in the eyes of the state of Mississippi, has been rehabilitated. And I was rehabilitated a long time ago, but now I got a court order that says that. And I can't tell you what that means to me. And the reality of it is I didn't know how much it was going to mean to me until we went to the hearing. And so we're leaving. And this outside talking sports with my lawyer, right? And this young man walked up to me, and he had tears in his eyes. And he had just left his lawyer. Remember I told you we were the next to last to go? He was the last to go. And he walked up to me, and he goes, hey, I want to tell you congratulations, man. And I want to be like you. He goes, I'm facing a lot of the same stuff you were facing. And I said, what are you facing? He said, man, they're trying to give me 30 years on some drug trafficking charges. And he goes, man, I've learned my lesson, and I want to turn my life around. And he goes, and you're an inspiration. And I looked at that complete stranger, and I told him that I loved him. And I told him that he could do it because I did it. And I'm nothing special. I'm just stubborn in the right way. And the thing that I realized is that this hearing had been rescheduled one time before. And the reason that it was rescheduled was because of that guy. That's what I believe. I believe that was a divine appointment, and I have no idea what's going to happen with him, but I have prayed for him every day since then, and I am a firm believer this. If he has broken the law, he has to be held accountable. You choose the behavior, you choose the consequences. But my hope is, whether it's at a satellite prison or in Parchman or wherever it may be, and he said I think 25% will be spent in county or whatever, no matter what it may be, I hope that God will use this moment to change his life. If people don't have consequences for their actions, they have no reason to change. But you can be a good person, and you can be an advocate for good and what's right in the world, no matter where you are. That's so important to know. And so there's so many things that happen in life that a lot of people pass off as coincidence. I don't believe in coincidence. I don't believe in any of that. I think everything has a purpose. I think every meeting, every chance meeting, every handshake, all of that has purpose. And I share that with you because, number one, I'm so incredibly grateful for my legal team. But as Casey Lott will tell you, he said, Steve, you're the poster boy for rehabilitation in Mississippi. And maybe that's true. I do think I'm an MDOC success story. And I learned my lesson. But I got a great legal team. And Casey and Clint, I love those guys as friends, right? Not just as my attorneys, but as people. I love those people. And they have done some amazing things for me. You know, when I was deposed in the Rebel Rags deposition, they're my legal team, right? And the deposition went so bad for the plaintiffs that they weren't real happy about having that thing on the record, you know. I can be a really good witness, right? And probably not good for people that are trying to conceal stuff. But I'm just want you guys to know that I'm so grateful for the life that I lead, the people that I have, and the job that I get to do, and the fact that I have all of you, right? There are so many bigger things in life than sports. And that sounds crazy considering that I've dedicated my entire life to covering sports, right? I have. But it's never too late to write a happy ending in your life. You may have encountered something that was incredibly difficult. You may have been abused. You may have been mistreated. You may have been conspired against and stabbed in the back. But you are the one that decides how it all ends. You are. And again, there's going to be moments in life where you have to make decisions. There's not going to be a search party that's going to be formed to come save you. You are going to have to walk yourself out of the woods. And so I hope that maybe this little story will inspire you, no matter what you're dealing with or what you're facing, that you will take ownership of your life and not let somebody else have the last say in how you're going to live. If you hadn't done so, come visit us at True Rest Float Spa of Starkville. You can dial 662-268-7601, speak directly to my lovely wife, Dana. She can answer any questions you have about floating. She can get you on the schedule. And no floating this weekend, no, because she's going to be with me. But floating has been such a benefit to our lives, and it could be for yours too. So be sure and check that out, and check out dutynoblebook.com. You get signed copies of all of my sports titles. Of course, that's Flim Flam, Stark Villains, Alpha Dogs, Dogpile, The Dude, and the personal memoir, When the Bottom Falls, where I talk a lot about my own addiction, my path to recovery, and the time that I spent in jail in an attempt to help other people. You can get signed copies of all those books. And come join us over at jeanspage.com. You can currently get 50% off the annual subscription price. Great time to save, great time to join. But until next time, let's all live our lives in a way we make more friends than enemies, and people can see a difference in the way we live.